Mike Bowen is at Master Control and taking care of business this morning. Good morning, Michael. How are you? He says, great. How are you? I am fine. Thank you for asking. It's wonderful to have Mike at the helm, as always. Good morning, everybody. We are very excited here because it's Friday. It was a four-day work week for a lot of people. And even with that, it still seemed really long, didn't it? And yet, here we are. We made it to Friday. So good morning, all. I feel, you know, as we meet together and most mornings and we get to, we get to talk about stuff. And so I just thought I would tell you a little piece of my life this morning. But we're having furniture delivered today. It's very nice. It's a big day in the Donahue household. We're getting furniture delivered. And I think the last time we had furniture delivered was when my wife and I were married about 30 years ago. So this is nice. Like, this is a new, like a whole new bedroom thing coming into the house. So we've been working on that. So I'm on my way to work this morning, and my text dings, and I look at it, and it says, "Hi, this is Rob, your delivery driver. I've started my route. Your stop is number 7, and you can follow my location here." Creepy, Jim. And then there's some rules there of things. I'll be back in touch to let you know when I'm about to head over. In the meantime, here's a little bit more about me. I love setting up kids' rooms, especially when they're excited about their new furniture. Outside of work, I enjoy fishing and kayaking and woodworking and sharing trivia, especially about music. And I look forward to delivering your new furniture today. So I called Kelly and I said, you got to get some good music trivia going for Rob. Right?
Yeah.
I don't know, it sounds more like a dating ad.
Right. I think he's moving in. I don't know. I think we're going to have him for a couple days.
So I have a real question.
Good news is you don't have any children's rooms.
I have a real question. So are you going to tip, Rob? And how much do you tip a furniture?
Okay, this is an excellent... My wife and I had this question. I Googled this morning, and there's various things. What do you think? I say yes.
Oh, of course, yes.
Yeah. Now, what if they bring like a crew of 50?
I know. That's
do you like
usually they don't. Usually there's one or two, and they like strap themselves to the appliance and just haul it up the stairs.
Yeah, I think you tip them.
You tip them?
Well, now see.
I offer bottled water.
Now say coffee.
That's very nice.
Would you like steel or sparkling?
I don't know. I feel. I think, you know, just at the point where you can, I'm doing him a favor. I put the dog in another room. Like, I don't, what more do you want? But no, it's a whole thing.
When we were getting my mom's house cleaned out.
Yeah.
And we had to get 4 truckloads of trash removal, as well as the 20 bags of stuff we threw out and the 30 recycling things. So the first guys came in, and I gave them a cash tip, and they were very appreciative. And then when they check out, you know, they have a thing and says, would you like to leave a tip? And they said, you already did that with cash, so they put 0. Okay. The next time the guys came in, I did, you know, I knew now it was going to give me an option, so I said, okay, I'll do it that way. And when the guys said, you know, the guys last time said you tipped in cash, I said, but it was less. And he said, yeah, but we get to keep it.
Oh.
Yeah.
So that was interesting.
You know, when our furnace blew up a couple of weeks ago, and ba-boom! And, of course, it's on a Sunday night, and it's cold, and you call the fuel oil company to come and fix the furnace. And then that was another question. Do you tip those? Because now, and this poor devil was coming up from Albany in the snow to fix our thing. And so we offered him a tip, and he said, no, I'm sorry. We don't take tips. Our line is that we are well compensated for what we do.
Well, if you're calling an emergency repair on a weekend, you're paying a lot just for the visit.
Yes, I know. I just felt, you know, like go get a hot meal. Well, anyway, good morning, everyone. Let me introduce the group before you. And if And Rob, if you're out there, let me know what you prefer.
Name the four Beatles.
Yeah, right. And the fifth Beatle, yes. Sienna Freeman-Tolbert is here, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hannah. Good morning, Sienna. How are you?
I'm good. I'm surviving.
Yeah, that seems to be a good answer these days. Bill Hammond is Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy. We're thrilled to have Bill with us. Good morning, sir. How are
you? Nice to be here, Joe.
Very nice to have you back. Jim Henler joins us, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. Jim Henler, good morning.
Morning, Joe. And I'm actually doing a little better, although my throat was getting a lot better until I spent 90 minutes on the side road of Route 85 waiting for the tow truck that never showed up.
Oh, but, dear.
But, you know, it was 22 degrees, so it wasn't so bad.
No, that's not bad. So did you tip him when he came?
actually, they called me back, and they explained to me that I could actually hide my keys in the car somewhere, leave a door open, and not be with the car when it got towed.
That doesn't sound safe.
I was like, well, compared to waiting another 2 hours in the cold, so I got someone to come pick me up, and
oh,
I did that.
All right.
And they hauled it to the place, and I wasn't there to have to deal with the tip issue.
That's good. Yeah. Judy Patrick joins us, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association. Good morning, Judy.
You know, I am especially delighted to be here today with Bill Hammond, who I worked with for many years, at the Daily Gazette.
Both of the Gazette.
The good old days.
Good old days. Yeah. We're remembering our youth.
Yeah, well, that's good. We've had a couple groups today of people who have worked together closely in different situations, and it's been a lot of fun. Of course, not just panelists who work together regularly, but that's very neat when paths cross like this. Good morning, all. We have a lot to talk about. We're going to get right to it. Panel at WAMC.org, if you would like to join us and join in on the conversation, maybe you have something to say about what's going on. Panel at WAMC.org. The President of the United States, the Chair of the Kennedy Center, and now Chair of the United States Postal Service, announced yesterday that he will take control of the Postal Service, firing the Postal Board. This, according to a Washington Post exclusive that was published in that newspaper last night. Trump is expected to make the announcement in full today, but is preparing to dissolve the leadership of the Postal Service and absorb the independent mail agency into his administration, potentially throwing the 250-year-old mail provider and trillions of e-commerce transactions into turmoil. Trump is expected to issue an executive order as soon as this week to fire the members of the Postal Service's governing board and place the agency under the control of the Commerce Department and Secretary Howard Lutnick. That, according to six people familiar with the plans who spoke on the condition of anonymity, out of fear of reprisals. Don't have to worry about that here, do we? Now, the board is planning to fight Trump's order. Three of those people told the Washington Post in an emergency meeting held last night. The board retained outside counsel and gave instructions to sue the White House if the president were to remove members of the board or attempt to alter the agency's independent status. Two of the group's GOP members, Derek Kahn, a former Trump administration official, and Mike Duncan, a former chair of the Republican National Committee, were not in attendance, according to a person familiar with the gathering. The two did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Trump's order to place the Commerce Department in charge of the Postal Service would probably violate federal law, according to postal experts. Another executive order earlier this week instructed independent agencies to align more closely with the White House. We talked about that in yesterday's program. Though that order is likely to prompt court challenges, and the Postal Service, by law, is generally exempt from executive orders. Members of the Postal Service's bipartisan board are appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. Trump, at Lutnick's urging, has mused about privatizing the Postal Service, and Trump's presidential transition team vetted candidates to replace Postmaster General Louis DeJoy. Although I've also heard it Louie. Well, we don't have to worry about him anymore, so I guess we can move on. A retired logistics executive and GOP fundraising official who took office in 2020 during Trump's first term. So that is where we are as of 9:23 on this Friday morning regarding the United States Postal Service. Judy, what do you think?
You know, the status of the post office has been debated for decades. If you ask most Americans, they believe it is a U.S. part of the U.S. government. But then there was this move to separate it from government control. There was a time when postal delivery was so important for every American, especially those in rural areas, to get access to information. It's being used less and less nowadays. I mean, talk about what mail you get every day. It's, I mean, hard mail. It's, you don't get that much.
Yeah. Well, except for the e-commerce, right? Except for the stuff that you order, that you order.
It should be noted that, I mean, Amazon relies on the U.S. Postal Service for a lot of its delivery, and how that will operate going forward is interesting to Jeff Bezos. So there's some political motivations allowed as well. Moving it to the Commerce Department, to me, seems the opposite of privatization. So I'd like to see what happens going forward. Do Americans really care about the Postal Service? I'm not really sure. Do they care about the price of stamps anymore? I'm not so sure. I don't even know what the price of a first-class stamp costs.
Well, no,
right now.
Because it's called forever. I mean, you don't know. It's not a 10-cent stamp or a 22-cent stamp. It's a forever stamp, and they change it, and you have no idea what it is. It's like when they started doing Easy Pass on the freeway. You didn't know what the tolls were anymore.
So I just want to point out that when we talk about the Postal Service, right, there's this document which has Article 1, Section 8, Clause 7. It's called the U.S. Constitution, which gives Congress the power to essentially establish post office, post routes, control the land for the post roads, build buildings necessary, define routes, et cetera, et cetera. So we're not only talking about something where Trump is trying to make a play to move something into the executive branch that by the Constitution belongs to the congressional branch. So there's been a lot of arguments about how to run it and stuff. The creation of the Postal Board was essentially a compromise that said, okay, we'll make it an independent congressional entity, thus fulfilling the Constitution, but giving, you know, Senate approval, right, lets it stay with us, even though the president's making nominations, and similar things happen for a lot of other organizations. This one, though, is not something where somebody arbitrarily passed a law at some random time in the past 100 years that Trump is throwing out, which there have been a lot of. This is one that literally goes back to the United States Constitution, which I vaguely remember that about 33 days ago, somebody put his hand on the Bible and said, you know, I promise to uphold that thing.
Actually he did not put his hand on the Bible.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Somebody just promised as much as he makes any promises. But yes.
It's
a fake.
I agree that, you know, the post office seems a little dated, and we all question, you know, the role it has in our day-to-day life now. But there is, you know, in my immigration brain, there are some aspects of the post office that serve an important purpose. For example, that's the one access point for a lot of people to get passports. That's the passport, you know, that's where you go to get your, take your picture, and they submit everything to Department of State for processing. So they serve important functions, and they're everywhere, right? In rural communities, urban communities. And so it makes it accessible to everybody. Without them doing this service, how would people go? You would have to go to a passport agency, which is mostly in like urban centers in along the East Coast or the West Coast. And then also you think about mail-in ballots. You know, everyone has, you're used to seeing the box. And so what does it look like for you to be submitting your vote for president and they control the agency that you're submitting your vote. Like, it just seems like it needs to be an independent agency. And so it's very concerning, actually. I know we don't get much mail. I look at it maybe once a week. I think it's my daughter's job to check the mailbox now because I just can't. But but I think it serves other functions that are so important. And maybe for us who live in these, you know, near these city centers, it doesn't seem as important, but for other people where they rely on it, for someone that uses FedEx, for example, and UPS frequently, we see how much the surcharge is to deliver to certain areas of the world and certain areas of the country. And so I can only imagine how it would affect individuals who don't have as much access to getting mail and things and packages and things like that.
I mean, the fact that, so as of July of last year, the price of a stamp is 73 cents.
Oof.
So, okay, you say woo, but you're going to take a letter and put it into a box in Albany, New York, and have it sent to Chicago.
Sitka, Alaska.
Or Alaska in 2 to 3 days, and it's going to cost you 73 cents. That's still not bad.
I have to say, I didn't have this on my bingo card that Trump would pick a fight over the post office. But reading, it was an occasion to learn a little bit of history, that in 1970, under the Nixon administration, there was a bipartisan agreement to reorganize the post office. It was kind of semi-privatizing it.
Yes.
But the problem back then was there was too much mail. Like they were overwhelmed with the volume because we hadn't invented email yet. And this
right.
was the only...
And now we're overwhelmed with that.
Well, it seems like rethinking the operation in the light of 54 years of change makes a certain amount of sense. The thing is, there's like everything the Trump administration is doing is shoot first, ask questions later. Like there's no laying the groundwork for...
No.
This is why we're doing what we're doing. There's no thinking process. It's just boom. And yeah.
Fun little fact, but Teresa Bourgeois, our panelist, and she texted me last night and said, just so you know, that yesterday was the 233rd anniversary of the creation of the U.S. Postal Service. So to your point, but Jim, but it's, you know, it's been around for a very, very long time. We'll talk about this more after news. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We're talking about the United States Postal Service, and President Trump is expected to take control of the Postal Service. I do think there's an interesting... The wording that we're using here is interesting in that we saw this with the Postal Service and we see this with the Kennedy Center, that it is not that the federal government is taking it over. It is not that this department is taking it over. It is that Trump is expected to take control of the United States Postal Service the same way as he will be chair of the Kennedy Center. And that... I think it just gives us a sense as to, I can't make any sense of it, so I don't really know what it gives us sense to.
It is indeed the 40,000 mile view, isn't it?
Yes.
About what is happening in so many segments of our society. You know, and it's interesting because I don't know how he has the energy for it. You know, unless there was a document, for example, that laid this all out, and he just is saying it's go time, and there are so many things. It just must be a great time to be a lawyer in Washington.
Power revs you up, though, right?
I guess. I don't know. I've never had it, so.
You know, when you're just like playing Risk or Stratego, you're like, all right, I'm going after the Postal Service.
I mean, constitutional law, like you're saying, constitutional law professors are like just, you know, licking their chops. I feel so bad for these law school students because the hypotheticals that are coming down the chain are, you know, it's like whiplash. Because we've never had to reference, like, you know, Jim was saying earlier, the Constitution so often, you know, it's only been, what, 4 or 5 weeks? I mean, it's really basics. It's like the government basics. What can they do? What can't they do? What aren't they doing? And, you know, something as that you just took for granted, such as, you know, him becoming bored with Kennedy Center. And you're just like, what? Wait, what? Paper straws, right? Like, you're just like, you're reading all these executive orders, and
wow,
you don't know.
I didn't know I had that.
I didn't know we could. You could do this.
And changing the name of the Gulf of Mexico.
Yes.
Wow. You know, like
stopping congestion pricing in New York City.
Well, that's right. Now, interesting you say this, but my nephew is a second year law student, and I was talking to him 3 nights ago, and he said he had a professor say in class, he goes, you know, I feel like we have to start from scratch. Like, I know you're a year and a half into this, but
everything's out the window.
Right. You know, we're trying to catch up. But
I mean, it's taking all the way back to Mulberry v. Madison.
Yeah,
it's at the very beginning.
Really fascinating. Gail says, wait a minute, people. Some of us need the Postal Service for paying bills, internet,
yes,
not reliable, receiving payments, not to mention ballots, actual letters. Can anyone spell rural? Joe is right. Getting a letter from the West Coast or Ireland or Tanzania is a gift. Other things are necessities. This may be the demonstration I'm waiting for. Thank you, as always.
Well, point of information, I think I just got a notice that Tanzania is on the list of places that you cannot receive mail. I believe so. But there's a list of places where the U.S. Postal Service is not receiving or sending mail right now. I mean, it came out. It's important to us in immigration because we have to know whether or not people in these countries can receive notices and things like that. But this is the small things that are happening in the background with the U.S. Postal Service.
Well, and let's take some other little things, right? I mean, how do you think most people get their Social Security payments every month? The Social Security administration is not doing that online unless you specifically request it to your bank, which is non-trivial to arrange if you don't know what you're doing. If you're living in a rural community which doesn't have good internet, your primary internet connection is your phone, and you're reliant on Social Security, getting rid of the post office is a lifeline. I mean, you know, people don't seem to think through these things to the depths of which, yeah, boy, I'll be upset that I don't get such and such a catalog.
But a lot of those small post offices have been closed over the years. I mean, years ago, I did a story where I drove around into like the hollows of Schoharie County and visited all these tiny little post offices. A lot of them have closed just because of economic necessity. So you are seeing a closing, and you're seeing shortening of hours. Anyway, there's still one in my town, but I've seen the other ones close. I mean, it used to be that being named postmaster was a political job.
Yes.
It was a very important thing to establish support at the local electoral level. That has no longer been the case.
But you bring up a good point. I mean, but it's different than, so Judy and I live in the same town. So within like 3 miles, there is the Greenwich Post Office, the Middle Falls Post Office, and the Schuylerville Post Office.
I think there used to be a Casayuna Post Office.
There is still a Casayuna Post Office. So the point being that, like, if you were talking about, we want to look and see if we can move in some of these, change these codes, bring these areas together, like, that's different, right? And then just, we're going to take this over. And then what? We don't know the second part of that sentence right now.
I mean, we don't know. I mean, he's talked about it. He's going to privatize it, and he's going to give it a contract to someone who wants it. And someone's going to run it. It's going to be like a for-profit business, and
who's going to be on the stamp?
Are the stamps going to will the stamps still be
ooh,
forever
the King
if they
Trump?
Do that?
Yeah. Oh, you know, that King Trump fake time. Like
remember when we were
would be
like,
a great stamp.
Remember when you were kids and you get like foreign stamps and they would be like, oh my God, they've got Mickey Mouse on them. That's the coolest thing. And then we're not far from that.
Yeah, we're trying to figure out whatever happened to my father's stamp collection that we think my mom at some point decided it wasn't worth anything and tossed it, which is really upsetting because I spent much of my childhood making sure that thing would be worth at least a few bucks.
Irene says, what? I love the post office. I go to the post office. I buy stamps. I get mail. We need the post office. Trump is ridiculous and should be told to keep his paws off the post office. that from Irene. I love the post office. I go to the post office several times a week. I mail bills. I write checks. I know you're giving me that look, Sienna. I know, but I do the other stuff too. I mean, there's things I do, but I like
goes,
to.
I do both.
I do both. But I also, and you know what? I don't want to go on a 20-minute rant, but it's like when they say, "Well, you can conveniently pay online."
My daughter doesn't even have a checkbook.
Yeah,
she's never written a check in her life.
You can't conveniently pay. Once you go to pay online, and they ask you for this, and they ask you for that, and you have to set up an account, and it takes 20 years, and it doesn't.
I took my children to the post office for the first time when they went to get their passports. They're like, "What is this place?" I said, "I give you."
Well, so I have
what is this place?
I have a kid who has had to move apartments roughly every year because of the escalation of expenses in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And therefore uses our home as their primary address for all package delivery and things like that. And then we take it to the post office and for a fairly small amount of money can get it to them within a day or two. And, you know, if we had to go through, I should be careful what I say. I own a lot of stock in one of these delivery companies, but, frankly, they don't compete. They fill a very different purpose.
He's not talking. I don't think the plan on the table is to get rid of the post office.
No.
In fact, I don't think we know what his plan is.
Well, right? That's right. It's to take it over.
But the thing is, there's something about the way the post office works now that's sort of fundamentally not economically viable. Like the idea that you have one price of a stamp that can go. Like, you pay the same amount to mail it across town as you do to mail it across the continent.
Yes.
That's like not a – that's not how a private sector entity would price things.
Which is exactly right.
Right.
That's why it's not a private sector entity.
But it's different for parcels. There is an increased cost if you're sending it to Alaska, a parcel.
But not compared to – some of the other services. Regardless of getting into the exact prices, it's really that, frankly, I think that part of it may have been that Trump discovered that the Royal Mail in the UK is technically owned by previously the Queen, now the King. It just happens to be the case. So my suspect is it may well be that this is just another thing kings do, and he wants to be king, so here's a king thing.
Good luck with our mail-in ballots now, says Charlie. Exactly. And then Sean says, I think some of the panel may be underestimating the importance of physical mail. Many small businesses rely on being able to affordably and reliably send mail to their customers. Also, there's something essentially democratic about the mail being something that just about everyone has access to. I assume there will be ramifications we can't even consider yet. Mail to incarcerated people?
I just think that's what it's all about, is equity and access, and that's why it's so important that we have the mail system, and it's a public service and not private.
You know, one of my pieces of advice to young reporters, if they can't get a hold of a source and they really need them, send them a written letter. It's like something they never would have thought of doing, and it can be very effective.
This is a great point from Janice. Lives in a rural area with no mail delivery and has a post office box, as do their neighbors. What happens to them? Will our mail be dropped in the side of the road? I don't know. I mean, that's a great question.
Joe, we could go on all day because
have till 10.
Well, no, I know. But I'm going to say, I could just give you a list of things where if they don't come through the mail, it violates other U.S. laws. So, for example, all those things you get from your medical insurance and from medical covers, most of those, even though they have a portal, they are mandated by law to send you in an envelope that doesn't even expose anything other than your address and where it's coming from. You just had this doctor visit. This is how much it costs. This is how much we paid. This is how much you should owe. Those things are covered by HIPAA, right? One of the strongest U.S. laws there is. A company, a sorry, a delivery company in California was fined millions and millions of dollars because the clear part on their envelopes was a little too open, and if you sort of pulled on it, you could see a little bit of the medical content inside, right? I mean, that's how strict these laws are, and again, may seem like a small thing, but you know, a lot of us go to doctors. A lot of us need that information. That information comes through the mail. Yes, you take a look at it, you put it in your recycling, but
and you still
you've
don't
seen
understand.
It.
You still don't understand.
And if they've turned you down, you know it. I mean, and that's the kind of stuff that really. So it's when things are non-normal and conforming to these very important laws, right, that we say we go back to the Postal Service because it's the most reliable delivery service there is. I mean, I don't know what to say. It's just yet another crazy thing.
Let's go back to the letters and go to...
This seems to be a topic the readers or the listeners are interested in.
Well, I think so. Because I don't know.
I think when you're in this context, you should make clear that you're not going to letters, you're going to email.
Yes. You did not receive these by mail.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point. You know, and when we started doing the show and we referred to this as email versus snail mail, boy, did the Postal Service get mad at us.
And when we do these.
Rightfully so. Yes?
And when we do the fundraiser, we ask everybody, would you like to do it by credit card or would you like to send a check? And we still get an awful lot of people who would rather send a check than pay by credit card.
Diane says, how about jury duty notices? Oh, that's right. That'll probably be gone next, says Diane.
Trial by jury. Yeah.
Yes. Then see you later. I'm pretty disturbed by the laughing up with what's going on about the post office that I'm hearing on your show today. Can we not see the end game here that in future elections they can control the postal mail-in ballots? All these pieces are pulling together to control future elections and make sure that this awful so-called administration and Project 2025 continues to do what it is doing. This is deadly serious stuff. We're crying on the inside.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, and you know, Joe, I thought I was arguing almost 2 months ago that was conspiracy thinking. I no longer believe that. Not so much over the individual controls and whether there'll be elections or not, but remember that Trump has essentially unlimited power for the next 2 years because that's when the congressional elections occur. Right, that could change the balance and force the stuff really to be constitutional challenges and things like that. And I think he's doing everything he can to consolidate what he can quickly, get things changed. It will take past the elections till a lot of these things hit the Supreme Court. And, you know, they're going to be, and his base is still his base. Gerrymandering has made it so that the number of congressional seats that are in danger of flipping is tiny. And, you know, I think really, I don't think Trump is the one who's making these decisions. I think people are putting pieces of paper in front of Trump and saying, hey, wouldn't this be a great idea for you to be the king of this mail service? Hey, wouldn't this be an idea that you could control the Kennedy Center and therefore all those DEI horrible things they do, like, you know, letting modern hip-hop groups that, strangely enough, don't seem to have white singers be the ones who are featured in shows and things like that?
I think I would just say briefly, I don't think anyone's thinks the potential dismantling of the democracy as we know it is funny. But I think we all have to survive. And we all have to kind of find a little levity as we try to figure out how to deal with what's happening. It's a lot of whiplash. Let's be honest. They're taking the underpinnings of what we are so used to. We're used to the post office. This is not a conversation therefore we're all surprised. It's not a conversation that we ever imagine having. You know, if we were talking about immigration, fair. You know, but the postal office, why does it exist? Does it need to exist? I mean, this is serious stuff, especially the individuals who rely on it. So I think we all understand how serious it is. I think it's just sometimes you have to kind of chuckle because it seems so, it doesn't seem fathomable. It doesn't seem like something that we'd ever be discussing.
And it's one of those things that does hit people. I mean, I can't, Judy mentioned this a moment ago, but the number of letters that we've gotten, emails, that we've gotten this morning, that's right, is off the charts. And I have yet to find one who has said, yeah, go down with the post office. They're all keep your hands off the post office, which I don't know, I think is very telling.
Well, I agree, Joe. And, you know, one of the things I've been noticing as I listen to the show every day is we usually get a few letters on just about everything that are you crazy liberals who don't understand the world. We're not getting that on the post office.
You know, Kirsten brings up a good point, and I'm going to read this letter, and then we'll address it when we come back from a break. But says, why is nobody screaming about the fact of how this happened? Trump is governing solely by executive order. Is this allowed? Isn't Congress supposed to be involved in some way? Ugh, with five H's. We'll take a break and be right back. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. I have to say, communications, however you want to put it, we have gotten so many emails on the subject. I can't even. First of all, we're not going to get to everybody because there's just too many of them. But most people are saying essentially the same thing. But I'm going to go through quickly as many as I can. Anybody who wants to jump in on the panel and talk about it, please. We'd like to we can continue that way. Christopher says, I totally agree. Wake up, stop laughing. American democracy is done. And I read that one and went before going to break. Okay, now we go to Annie. The discussion is focusing too much on the pros and cons of the Postal Service. What we should be discussing is that taking control of the Postal Service is another direct violation of the Constitution, as was mentioned in the beginning of the discussion. Another way in which number 47 is violating his oath is it is another example of how he's violating his oath, period. Time for Democrats to introduce articles of impeachment. I know they will go nowhere, but it should be done. Then Kevin says, first-class typical letters are at the fixed forever rate. Everything else is prorated by distance and weight. In the past, the USPS survived on income from prepaid mail, catalogs, and magazines. They recently upgraded facilities to improve their package deliveries and be competitive and collaborative with FedEx and UPS. Trumpifying it will lead to the same path as Trump steaks and Trump vodka. Then
I have a point of correction. It wasn't yes. Tanzania. It was Tajikistan that was not allowed to receive.
I get those two confused all the time.
Those T's.
Yes. Hey, can I also make the point that there are some local newspapers that still rely on the post office for delivery of their paper. In fact, there's been a trend back towards using the post office in some places.
I also have to say, and you can call me corny, I don't care, but there very much is that we have our community centers, and the post office so much a community center. I mean, you want to find out what's going on. If the fire whistle went off last night at 11:30, does somebody hear something? Oh, is it just the door? Oh, okay. All right. I'm sorry. I had voices in my head, which is not unusual, but wanted to correct it for you, the listener. You want to find out. A fire whistle went off at 10:30 last night. You want to find out what it was? Go to the post office the next morning. You'll find it out like that. There is that element to it. Not that I think there are other places, but it is. I think it's interesting because they are centers of our community because they are in every community. Joseph writes and says, Congress created the U.S. Post Office under the Jefferson administration, the U.S. Postal Service, the creation of the The U.S. Postal Service is a governmental creation of the Reagan administration, is not the U.S. Post Office. The goal is to privatize everything. That means making sure that companies like UPS, DHL will be charging for regular mail service. And that from Joseph. And then we go down. I'm having trouble keeping up because there's so many letters coming in. Allie says, mail post office ballots, foreshadowing what may become the beginning of our monarchy. This guy shows what he's going to do. We just need to actually believe him. Then Kitsy says, controlling the post office is about control of voting access. The recently proposed SAVE Act will require a birth certificate or a passport to vote. Where does everyone go to get a passport? The post office. How do college students vote absentee? Through the mail. It's about limiting voting. Then we go to Janice, who says that we did do that letter about post office boxes. The post office, John says, the Postal Service is just another example of the executive branch gaining control, another step toward authoritarianism. How can Trump's approval ratings be so high?
So there's so many of these issues. This is one of a thousand things that Trump is doing that's triggering people. We don't know the legalities, right? Like the exact contours of what he wants to do versus what the law says haven't been explored yet and will have to go through the courts, which takes time. Then there's also the politics of it. As his ideas become more public, there'll be a public backlash, as we're seeing right now, letters pouring in. All of this is going to unfold. It takes time. We're in the middle of the fog right now. And we don't.
What I will say about the legalities of it, and this is my legal opinion about it, is that we saw this during the FDR's administration. He had like a lot of FDR and I think Nixon, right? That was, I think the judges, more importantly, the justices agree that agencies belong with the executive branch. It was Congress that came in and stepped in. Congress came in and put guardrails around and made these semi-independent agencies. So I think the problem with relying on the courts in this instance is that the courts may say, you know, in the Constitution, these agencies, you know, they are executed by the executive branch. It's Congress' job to come in and put those guardrails around them. And if Congress is not acting, then we don't have any guardrails. I think that's the problem. I think the court is going to step back in these instances and say, this is the way it rolls. Yes, you know, it's up to Congress to put these guardrails on it and enforce and make sure that these guardrails work.
But if it's as unpopular as it seems to be, that's what will get Congress to act.
Exactly.
Well, and you know, the Trump administration may back off a few of these things because when they don't play well, they don't care much. But
the problem is Congress doesn't have incentive to act until closer to the midterms.
Yep.
And that's the problem we're seeing here.
Yeah, exactly.
I do also just want to say we have a couple letters on this, and I think it's a good point. But another use of the post office is mail or is money orders. And for people in rural and urban areas and people who have no other way to pay a bill, that is the way to do it, where you can actually take cash, get the bill, and pay it. So that is another thing that was brought up by our listeners this morning.
That's also how a lot of funding goes to foreign countries through their
Correct. Their
immigrants here.
You know, this is reminding me of somebody who came up in the newspaper business. People cherish newspapers even as they use them less and less and less, and even as their economic model came apart. And if somebody came in and said, we're abolishing newspapers, everybody would be up in arms, but they're still used. They're not reading newspapers. They're not subscribing to them. I think the post office is in the same situation. They've a lot of their functionality has been taken over by technology that's just a gazillion times more efficient. They still have this role as anchors in our communities. They still have all these other, you know, sort of technical things, you know, in terms of disclosures and mail-in ballots and things like that. But the structure that exists was built around a much bigger job of delivering millions upon millions of letters that aren't being mailed today.
I have to say, I started this off by saying I'm a regular user of the post office. Only one person on the panel looked at me askance. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll move on to other issues. There is much more to discuss, and we will do exactly that. First News with Ray Graff. Ten minutes past 10 o'clock on this Friday morning. Good morning and welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Let me tell you who's on the show. Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association. Jim Hendler, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. Bill Hammond, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy. And Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. All right, we're going to move on to other topics on this Friday morning and go to the issue of Guantanamo Bay and look at why the Trump administration abruptly cleared out migrants that it sent to Guantanamo, a transfer operation on Thursday. Repatriated 177 Venezuelans via a handoff in Honduras, while one migrant was brought back to U.S. soil. Bill Hammond mentioned earlier when we were talking about the post office stories that a lot of the stuff just comes out without any of, as he used the term, the groundwork that was put into it. This was one of those. We're going to send everybody to Gitmo. We're going to send them to Guantanamo Bay. And then they sent them to Guantanamo Bay, and a lot of people got really upset. And now they've cleared it out, and we'll see what happens. The Trump administration transferred all of the migrants that it had brought to the U.S. military base, suddenly emptying a detention operation that it had just as abruptly started this month. Two passenger planes operated by Global X, a charter aircraft company, flew to the naval base on Thursday morning, shuttled most of the migrants to an airfield in Honduras. They were to then be put aboard a Venezuelan plane for repatriation. Tricia McLaughlin, a spokeswoman for Homeland Security, said 177 migrants had been transferred to Venezuelan custody and one had been brought back to an immigration facility in the United States. In a declaration filed in court earlier on Thursday, an Immigration and Customs Enforcement official had said 178 Venezuelans were at the base. It is and was unclear whether the administration intended to send additional migrants to the base in the future. Sienna.
I don't think they will. This was the reason why they had to get them out of Guantanamo Bay is because Guantanamo Bay is still within the district court, is covered by the district court in D.C., right? And there was questions about access to lawyers for them, and they had all these rights that they were guaranteed. So that's why the litigation came up. In order to stop that litigation, what they did was they moved them on to Venezuela or probably to Panama is where they would put them if they can't go, because when they're in Guantanamo Bay, the U.S. government is still executing the removal order, right? It's the same as if they were sitting sort of in Texas or in New York. They're still executing the removal order. The U.S., we still have kind of jurisdiction over them, and they still have legal rights that we could exercise as attorneys. We can go in and see whether or not their final removal order was justified, whether we can reopen them, there's anything we can do for these individuals. However, if you can get them out of the country to a place like Venezuela or they put them in a place like Panama, now our standing is questioned, whether or not we can sue, for example, to have access. Are you following what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In terms of...
So in other words, you think that this is better and yet it's worse.
It's worse, right? It's good for them because they're not there, obviously, in Guantanamo Bay. You don't want the individuals there. We'd rather they be somewhere where lawyers can get to them and talk to them and determine that they have their rights and question why they're there, and there's more transparency. But now it's a little bit worse because now they're deporting them to places like Venezuela and Panama, where it's no longer within, whether we question whether we have standing once they're outside of our country jurisdiction.
So I heard an NPR report this morning on this very subject that said that the detainees we're talking about, the people being deported, had been detained and ordered for deportation before the Trump administration took over. And so it left the impression that this was all a lot of theater, that the Trump administration wanted to show that it was taking immediate action on immigration, on deporting people. It had a group of detainees that could move around. It moved them to Gitmo because it knew that would get attention. And then it sounds like there's a legal reason why leaving them there would have been compromising.
Exactly.
But it sounds like a whole lot of theater that doesn't necessarily signify much, right? I never understood the advantage. Like, why would you use Gitmo? It's not even convenient.
Well, because they didn't have any, as it stands, it's very hard for them in terms of detention. Where are they keeping all these individuals that they're detaining?
They have space there, right?
Yeah, so yeah. The final removal orders were usually under supervision of ICE during the Biden administration because they were found not to be a danger to society, and they probably had something pending. They had something pending, or they were doing something, or they had a reason why they weren't executing the removal order. So it was easy for ICE officers to go out. They have their addresses. These individuals had been reporting. Most individuals are able to get a work permit during this time because they're reporting to ICE. So that's the benefit for them reporting to ICE and ICE knowing where they're at. And all it took was for ICE to go to those addresses where they were reporting or to ask them to report one more time, detain them, and then to get them outside the U.S. And so that's what we're seeing a lot of when they're trying to, you know, meet, quote unquote, these quotas, is they're taking in these individuals that had been reporting and they had incentive to report to ICE because they were able to get them work permits. And those individuals are being detained, and then they're being taken out of the country.
We keep hearing that the idea that the numbers are so low of the people who are being deported that it's driving the president nuts. And Kristi Noem, who is the Secretary of Homeland Security, said we have to work harder to get the dirt bags off the streets.
It's so hard because unless someone was reporting, then you don't know where they are. Unless someone breaks the law and they're detained by law enforcement, then you don't know where they are.
Okay.
So it makes sense that, and so that's what, so they're saying we're getting the criminals off. You were always getting criminals off the street because if someone broke the law, they were detained by law enforcement, their biometrics were taken, and at that point you knew their immigration status.
But is this statement true that I'm about to say, which is, or the reason is because the problem was not as bad as it was advertised to be?
That statement is true.
Okay. There you go.
The other thing I found interesting is this super cost-cutting government efficiency, et cetera, et cetera. There have been several reports on the cost of moving the immigrants to Guantanamo. So even if you don't look at it from the political sphere, which I think is wrong, I agree with Sienna completely, but it costs something like 4 to 6 times as much money to keep someone at Guantanamo as it does to keep them in a U.S. facility. Getting them there, they were paying, different numbers have been floated around, but sending 10 prisoners to Guantanamo was costing $10,000, $12,000 because they were of the kind of, they had to use either private charters or for a while they were using military planes, which are much more expensive. So it doesn't even make sense from the point of view of we're doing this for the sake of helping the economy. There was just no good reason, no matter what you looked at, except theater.
You know, I agree about the theater aspect of this. This is the administration trying to show his base, his supporters, that he's working hard to clear our streets of people who shouldn't be here. But at the same time, I'm very upset about the lack of transparency because we didn't know who these people were, why they were there, and reporter access to Guantanamo is very limited. And at a time when we really need transparency from government, we're not getting it, especially on this issue. And removing it all the way to Guantanamo accelerates that in a way that is hard to compensate for.
Yeah, I completely agree, but I think it's even more scary that they're moving them to places like Venezuela when they may not necessarily be from Venezuela, or they're moving them to Panama when they may not necessarily be from Panama. So our individuals who are stateless or who don't have countries that will accept them back, moving them to these other countries is scary. It should be scary for individuals who are green card holders or even U.S. citizens who may be profiled and they can't prove that they're necessarily a U.S. citizen, to think that you might get on a plane and they're going to deport you to a place that will accept individuals from our country. I think that's the scariest part of this for me, is that, you know, before, if you weren't able to be accepted into your country wasn't accepted or you're stateless, you had to remain in the U.S., right? You remain in the U.S., they try to figure out where you should go, or you remain detained in the U.S. where you have some kind of rights. The idea that people who are stateless have to go to Panama or Venezuela, they'll accept them there, is scary because you, at that point, how do you exercise your rights from that country?
Also, out of the 187, my understanding was that one of them was brought back to the U.S. because they shouldn't have been deported at all. I don't know what the details are, again, because of the transparency issue, but no one has explained why this one person was treated differently. And the only explanation that I've seen in anything written is that perhaps it was because that person shouldn't have been there in the first place. Mm-hmm. And again, no legal rights, because once you're in Guantanamo.
Bill, do you want to say anything?
There's a lot of details on this that I'm not familiar with. I know that another aspect of the theater might be that Gitmo has an international reputation. And so the Trump administration is trying to get countries like Venezuela and Colombia and trying to get them to cooperate with the deportation. And if you put a set of nationals from that country at Gitmo, it makes news at an international level. Like, it has this fearsome reputation and it's high profile and it gets attention in those other countries. There's this interesting dynamic we have with other countries in the Western Hemisphere where being willing to cooperate with the United States is a political liability in a lot of those countries,
yeah.
You know, regardless of who the president is. And so, yeah, it's...
I mean, and the theater works, right? There's a lot of fear in these communities right now. Just the fear that if, I'll be very candid, the fear is that if you have an accent, you might be picked up, regardless of your status. You have to prove what your status is. If you're unable to prove what your status is, then you may go to Gitmo, or you may go to some other country, and your family and friends will have a hard time getting you back into this country. That's the fear. It's working on everyone. These stories are running on all the networks, and that's very, to me, un-American.
I want to go, we're going to change subjects real quick. Jennifer Burns, who's a panelist on our program, wrote me a note and said, please mention that USPS changes may be a strategy to interrupt or track the shipping of reproductive health care medications as well as other mailed medications. It targets women and other less mobile Americans, in effect, a different way to reintroduce a Comstock-like outcome, which is a great point, and I thank Jennifer for writing in.
Oh, yeah, wonderful point. We should have thought of
it.
All right. We asked her to be on the show today, but she had to work.
I'm glad she's listening. I just heard.
Okay. But thank you very much for that. All right. Let's go to other topics in the moments we have before our bottom of the hour break. And we go to we're going to stay with migrants and benefits for migrants. The Trump administration has signed an order, what to know about Trump's order targeting federal benefits for migrants. Most undocumented immigrants are ineligible for federal benefits already, but here's what the directive could mean in practice. President Trump signed an executive order yesterday aimed at eliminating federal benefits for undocumented migrants, saying those benefits are an incentive for people to come to the United States illegally. But for the most part, the federal government does not provide funding for people who are in the country without authorization. The direct is short on specifics, but it says that Mr. Trump wants all federal agencies to find out what government funds are being given out improperly. The Office of Management and Budget and the so-called DOGE, Department of Government Efficiency, have 30 days to find other streams of federal funding to people who are in the country illegally.
Now, this is theater, because there are not many federal benefits that are given out to immigrants, to individuals, unless it's like a humanitarian program. So, for example, if you apply for asylum, while your asylum is pending, you may be eligible for some services. If you apply via the Violence Against Women Act, so that means you've experienced extreme battery or cruelty by a U.S. citizen, a green card holder spouse, then you are allowed to get some sort of benefits, because it makes sense, because you have to leave that dangerous situation and you may need some resources. They're all humanitarian based if you are, in order to get any sort of benefits from the U.S. Everyone else is penalized for using public benefits. This means that if, when you go to apply for a green card down the road, 5-6 years, they're going to ask you if you ever used any public benefits. And if you say yes, that's a problem in terms of you getting a green card. So this is definitely theater, because there's not, other than humanitarian avenues, most immigrants are disincentivized to use public benefits. They won't touch it because they don't want to impact their ability to get a green card in the future.
Bill?
There's one area that happens to fit into my work recently where there are benefits available is health care. They're limited. There's something called emergency Medicaid. So if you're an undocumented immigrant, you get in a car accident, you go to the hospital, Medicaid will cover the care you need to get through that immediate crisis. It won't cover you for your insulin, for your diabetes. It won't cover you for your primary care, but it will cover your emergency health care needs. I just so happened to recently, as part of a Freedom of Information request, I got some data from New York State about that. There are about 480,000 non-citizens who have signed up to be part of the emergency Medicaid program in New York State, and the state spends about $600 to $900 million a year for that population. So it's, I don't know, like, it sounds like this executive order is saying we're looking for improper spending. Emergency Medicaid is being done by law, right? So it's not improper. Is he trying to stop that? I don't know. But that is one area where the federal government spends probably nationwide a certain amount of money providing health care for immigrants in emergency situations.
And they, sure. Agreed. And you see that with individuals who are pregnant, right, who, and they may need health care. They're not going to deny those. But what happens is, what happens in the long term, for example, if someone comes on a visitor visa, overstays, and they have a baby, and they take advantage of Medicaid or what have you, if they leave the country and they try to reenter, we've had instances where people have been denied entry because they took advantage of those systems.
Because of the public charge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it's, so they are penalized. So they're, I think there's already a system in place to kind of help, you know, make it a detriment to them to use these public benefits in an improper way. You know what I mean?
So the one, yeah. So Bill, building on what you said, and Joe, it's in the article in the Times, but yeah. It's mentioned that
2-minute warning.
There are some exceptions for emergency medical care and public schooling for children. In general, they can't do it, but these two particular things are enshrined in the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1996. So again, this is a case where Congress has given these people permission to have some particular things under particular circumstances, and now the administration is going to question yet another congressional action. I think the public schooling one, we've already seen a lot of public school systems expressing fear over the fact that they have this right to educate these children, and ICE is starting to come into the schools and say, hey, when the parents come to pick up these kids, we can arrest the parents and the kids. I mean, it's yet another avenue for them to get around a law that was passed for the benefit of people in the United States.
Yeah, I'm really wrestling with this a little bit because from a media perspective, how much do you cover these stories, which by many measures are just designed to scare people? Are we beholden to reporting everything that he's doing or are filming and airing every ICE raid? I think we may be, but do we make it the top of the news hour after hour after hour? There are so many stories coming down the pike that there's lots to choose from, and I think we really have to assess what's important, what's real, and what's not. The problem is, at this point, we don't know what's real and what's not.
We're going to take a break, and we'll continue our conversation. We'll have our last go-around with this terrific group in just a moment. We always welcome your letters. Last call. Your emails. panel@wamc.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 21st of February, 34 minutes past 10 o'clock, about 10 or 11 minutes left with this wonderful group. And we'll get to another issue or two. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. So let's talk about, since we have Jim here and we've been sort of talking around this all week, but they're just looking over the struggle over Americans' personal data playing out across the government. Employees from Elon Musk's so-called Department of Government Efficiency, and that is what the New York Times is referring it to as the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, are gaining access to vast amounts of information held by federal agencies, even as lawsuits try to stop them. Last week, Michelle King, the acting commissioner of the Social Security Administration, sought to reassure Democrats on Capitol Hill about the presence of two of Elon Musk's allies at her agency. The Social Security Administration keeps medical information, bank account numbers, and other sensitive personal data about the roughly 70 million Americans it provides with more than $1 trillion in benefits annually. In the February 11th letter to Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon and guest last week on this program, Ms. King said that the two representatives from the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, had yet seen personal information and said any disclosures would follow established procedures. Days later, Mr. Musk's team sought access to the agency's data. Ms. King resisted the request, and by Monday night, she and her chief of staff, Tiffany Flick, were out of their jobs, according to three people familiar with the departures. The Trump administration elevated Leland Dudick, a relatively low-level staff member who had previously collaborated with DOGE, to temporarily lead the agency. Jim Hendler, you were with us a week ago. We talked about this issue a bit. You were trying to calm the fears of one of our panelists, Teresa Bourgeois. Good luck. And has it changed a little bit? Is it?
That evening, I sent Therese an apology saying, you were right, I should have scared. But, you know, she was picking on a very narrow piece of it. But it's the overall thing that's scary. And here's really something that I make a point of in one of my classes, which is I teach a class on data and privacy and all that stuff, is we allow businesses in the U.S. to have insane amounts of personal information that is forbidden to the government. And prima facie, it looks like that doesn't make sense. Why wouldn't you let the government have information at Amazon or Microsoft, et cetera? And one of my students put it very well. Amazon, Microsoft, Google can't arrest you. They can't, you know, come take away your benefits. They can't do things that the government has the power to do over the citizens, whether legally or not. And that's why we have law courts and all these other wonderful things. But getting access to this data through a quasi-governmental agency that then releases it to parts of the government that may not be eligible to have it, that uses it, you know, they're, quote, going to use their AI techniques to find fraud. I will tell you, even if they use the state-of-the-art stuff and ran it for insane amounts of time, you'd be getting 93-94% accuracy, which means the other 6% are being penalized for things they shouldn't be penalized for. On and on and on. Just think of all the times you've gotten an advertisement that seemed totally inappropriate, right? Now imagine instead of that being somebody selling you a toilet seat, that's someone knocking on your door at 11 o'clock at night and saying, come with us, you're going to jail, right? That's what we're talking about. We're talking about absolutely major violations of constitutional amendments, congressional laws, on and on and on. Data security, data privacy in the government, from the government, has been enshrined in our laws for a long time. Data privacy from companies has been something that's been very controversial. There's been bipartisan legislation trying to fix that for the past 16 years. And every time it gets close, something weird happens.
May I just say, I can't help but think about, you know, my concern is for, you know, where I work in immigration. And I think about all the people that filed asylum claims against their home countries and their promised confidentiality, right? Because that's scary to say things about your government and to think that they might have access to that. I think of the people that have filed, like I said, Violence Against Women Act against their U.S. citizen spouse or LPR spouse and their promised confidentiality. Someone has access to that. I also think about all the clients that I've said for the last over 15 years of practice, please file taxes. Even if you don't have status, you should file taxes. Get an ITIN number and file your taxes. It's not, these two agencies, you know, they don't really communicate. It's not a big deal. Now, all these individuals that have given their information, they've paid taxes to the U.S. government, all that information is now have, it's all there. It's been compromised. And so it is a big deal. And then on my small pedestal, I think about TikTok. And how I understand the concern. Don't go how China, yes, dangerous, but it was a big deal. Bipartisan, we're going to pass this. Our data is, you know, secure it. And then here we go. Some, they're just in there in the data, looking through everything. I'm just saying for all, I said small pedestal. And we're all just looking and saying, okay.
Yeah, but what about?
But what about data?
You know, I was taken when President Trump had a press availability in the Oval Office, and Elon Musk was behind him, wearing his T-shirt, a sports jacket, and had his kid on his shoulders. And well, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm just painting a picture. But and he talked about how federal workers were getting wealthy at taxpayers' expense. And he was saying that somebody that had a $85,000, $95,000 a year job had hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars in the bank. My question was, how did they find that out? I mean, how private is that information, and how were they able to ascertain that? That seems to me to be very scary.
Well, that one was easy. They just made it up. It turns out to be totally – no, I'm serious. It turns out
well,
to be,
that's easier.
Turns out to be totally untrue. There are probably some federal employees who do have a lot of money in the bank because, for example, if you make a lot of money, then go join the federal government, your pay drops, but you still have your savings and your investments. So I spent 2 years working for – 3 years working for one of the agencies. It was on – a way that university professors are able to come in without losing their salary. If you made more than a certain amount, then you did have to lose that in your salary. A lot of my benefits had to be moved, things like that. I did it because public service is a good thing to do. Well, guess what? You know, if you were to say, hey, look, this guy was being paid this much by the government and look how much money he has in the bank, wouldn't include anything I've ever gotten through inheritances, wouldn't anything I did through outside consulting when I wasn't in the government, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I don't have millions and millions of dollars in the bank, let me just be clear, but even this, but, you know, sort of any of these numbers they're throwing around, virtually every number that has been fact-checked has been found to be wrong.
So when he says, when Elon Musk says that the suggestion in within the remark is that they know the network worth of federal employees, that they then do not have that information.
Well, they may or may, you know, we don't know what information they've gotten to. We do know they got to GAO information, which is where that information on what they're paid is. Doesn't necessarily have that. But for example, I had to fill out a form that says, here's all the entities that I have any kind of business relationship. Here's all the advisory boards I've been on. Here's these things. There's a conflict of interest statement. If they've got access to my 240Ds, as they're called, which is what you need to get a classification through the government, then they have a huge amount of personal information that they can compare what I was paid as a government employee, which, by the way, was zero, and what I have in the bank. I mean, and, you know, the top-ranked government officials were making less money, not only than their corporate equivalents, but their academic equivalents. And, you know, professors are not known as the highest-paid people in America, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's... You know, it's hard to believe that even if they get these numbers, that they're interpreting them in any useful way. Because, again, you can inherit money from somebody and decide you're going to go work for the government.
We have to leave it there. We're out of time. But my thanks to everyone for being with us on this Friday. I hope you have a beautiful weekend. And I so appreciate all of you being here and sharing your expertise with all of us. Thank you very much. Sienna, Jim, Bill. Judy, thank you. We'll continue with our roundtable program and much more coming up after this.